Hi everyone, we are Eddie and Iggy, and this is our podcast.
I'm Edith Lazar. I am a fashion theorist in the making, art writer and curator.
My name is Igor Koruga. I am a choreographer, dance dramaturg, and also cultural worker. And in this podcast, we focus on a matter of how can one nowadays think about new formats or approaches of care when it comes to depression. What are the new approaches in self-care? How can we speak about depression within institutions and what sorts of care could take place there? And also, we will discuss a little bit about, are we living in an era of hopelessness and what does this mean?
So all of this was for me interesting because it reminded me on how in such conditions that we constantly live and change, we are always in a situation that we get exhausted and that we always get this sort of advice, but you should take care of yourself.
Yes.
Like you should get better. You should feel better. Try sleeping regularly. Try to do your bodily practice regularly. Try to go to, you know, bedtime regularly, not late or something like this. So all these things for me become questionable because I'm really curious, what does it mean to take care of yourself today when you speak about all these conditions of exhaustion that come in? Like you talk about, how do you curate depression? But also before curating depression, it's also like how you take care of yourself in order to deal with depression.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes, I think it's a very good point of starting about this conversation because, I mean, this way of working, I think it's mostly, most of the people working in the arts, like ground level or middle level, can relate to. Because even if you work in a small organization, there's always this idea that you have to perform your work and you rely on other people and you always work from project to project and you don't know if it's going to get the money you need in order to do it.
Yes.
So always a little bit, you have gaps in between, you have people coming, people going all the time.
Yes.
So always to find ways, you know, also to rely on other friends and their work and so forth. So it gets to that point of exhaustion, even when you have someone to back you up. And it's quite of so how do you take care of yourself in this context? It's quite a good question. Also because there is all this spectrum of care. You can do yoga, you can meditate, and all that, but it's more like a mantra of self-help. That only, you know, gives you a little bit of a break in order to put you back.
And when we deal or try to diagnose the issues of care and especially issues of exhaustion, depression and some other negative feelings, we also, of course, always say, but it's not only like a medical thing, like medical diagnosis, it's also a socially cultural situation of living under capitalism. So we always put ourselves in a sort of a distance with criticality towards the system, saying it's also the system that is making us depressed. But I also became interested in this thing about that it's not only that we are the ones who are sufferers of the system that is controlling all of us, but also we are, in a way, allies with the system because we are intertwined in the real power relations that do create the system. And it is also us, in a way, who do establish conditions for neoliberalism to grow. I think there is something about this sentence that I really liked in the book of Ant Cetkovic, this theoretician that was writing about depression, saying, I know I wake up every morning on the wrong side of capitalism, but saying capitalism is the problem does not help me get out in the bed from the bed in the morning. So this is where I become interesting about how can we create and have also specific, like alternative and new distance towards the whole situation of exhaustion and depression under neoliberalism. How can we also radicalize the practice of self-care within it? And point.
Yeah, so I think this with radicalizing, one of the ideas was that, so at least in the article I was talking about in the beginning, it's what, how you put resistance to that. And mm-hmm. one, it's one that it goes both bodily and mentally, and I'm sure both of us have experienced it. And it's this, I can't.
Yes.
You literally cannot do it.
Yeah.
It's whatever people are telling you, of course you can. Try a little bit harder. Mm-hmm. Do that. Of course you're going to. No, just have a good night, mm-hmm. right? Drink some tea, go to yoga, it's gonna help you, mm-hmm. but you cannot. You do all these self-help, you know, small tricks, but then you cannot do it. You're literally in the position that your body as a whole, your mind as a whole refuses
yes.
to do anything.
Yes.
So that was one of the things, like how I can. And there's also these cases of artists that have refused the artwork.
Mm-hmm.
They decided, okay, I'm going against it,
mm-hmm.
goodbye. And it's this very beautiful book by Martin Herbert,
mm-hmm.
which is called Tell Them I Said No.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an entire nice description about some of the artists and their motives to basically renounce the artwork. But the trick is that they were already recognized artists.
Mm-hmm.
So they had, in a way, the privilege
to say it,
to
yeah.
say no.
Of course.
Okay? I'm in that position that I'm already accomplished, or I did enough for me to be visible when I say
mm-hmm.
no to you.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I say no and nobody cares,
mm-hmm.
then that no, it is a form of resistance from me to
mm-hmm.
to the force that it's, you know,
mm-hmm.
that you feel like it's coming upon you. But then what the statement somehow doesn't go further, because you're not that of important to a system
mm-hmm.
to be taken into consideration as resistant.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think it's also like finding a way to say no or get, or also going further somehow, but in a different way.
We can speak about taking care of, like, you know, I don't know, as you said, doing yoga, do this regular bedtimes, going to bed and sleep 8 hours and so on. But still, tomorrow we have to go into this same project, or tomorrow we still have to search for a job, and that we don't know when or if we are going to get, and so on. So what you said today in the beginning of the text was when you explained this, not the text, but the talk, that when you explained this day you had today, and when you said this nothing, like I really decided to do nothing, I think it is also about having an awareness that you are not, that you're purposely not doing anything.
Or it's not like you're not doing anything, because you do things
mm-hmm.
that are either mechanical or you wanted to do, and but it's somehow not related
mm-hmm.
to that performativity you're in,
mm-hmm.
because sometimes you say, oh, I'm gonna take a break and it's something that I always wanted to do, but it's something is actually very much related to your work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you're contributing to this kind of performative, but also doing nothing, basically you're taking a break in order to do something
mm-hmm.
afterward. So for me it was more like, okay, I have a lot of things to prepare,
mm-hmm.
so I'm gonna take a day in which to do nothing in order to gather my energy, but that just implies that I'm going to back into track
mm-hmm.
with energy ready to perform my intellectual quality.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's always this performative thing. And also if you make this kind of act of resistance
mm-hmm.
and you say no and I can't,
mm-hmm.
but then it is also this thing that you're making a sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And how you cannot make this sacrifice somehow. I'm just thinking about it. Like how not make it look like it is a sacrifice. Because actually you're renouncing something that is very important for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think I was telling you about this Bifo's book, Heroes, that is talking about suicides and different sorts of mass suicides or murders and that happened in the 90s and 2000s and covering really some even, let's say, publicly known ones, like shootings in American schools or this shooting that happened in Norway with Breivik and some also in China. But so he touches upon the subject of suicide, but what for me was interesting was this example of the fabric, Apple fabric in China, where so within I think 1 year or something like this, there was like 18 suicides that workers committed in the
factory.
Mm-hmm. And what is disturbing is that not only actually the number of how many suicides happen, but the fact that the owners, the directors, or CEOs of the factory decided, instead of helping to their people, like their employees, they decided to build a net
around the safety net,
so that when people try to jump, they don't die, but they go into net.
Yes, it's very interesting because that became like a regular practice for a lot of other factories. Mm. So instead of putting bars, like you're in a jail, and getting back, you know, to this surveillance and incarceration by work. This became a normal practice in what we call today the third world, because that's where most of the Western labor is outsourced. So we have a lot of time to think and have free time and holiday time, because other people in other parts of the world are working for you. So this is how time, and they don't have the time. So it's also the luxury of time that comes into existence through this. And it's mostly with everything, including IT. Because in Eastern Europe, these IT businesses have grown so much because there is a real market demand from the Western part for the works to be outsourced, because it's cheaper.
And also the example with Lufthansa
airplane that crashed many years ago, when the pilot crashed the airplane with 150 passengers or maybe less, but definitely everybody died. And this thing that after several days after it was after the investigation, it turned out that the pilot had a history of with depression. And so it was immediately in media published like, oh, you know, he was depressed.
It's
and
his
like,
fault.
It's his fault. And it's like, oh, it's fine. He was like basically a lunatic who was depressed and killed other people without actually going so much deep into the conditions of the work where he was employed. Like this that I found out recently, that in order to, when you work as a flight attendant, you have to have 90 hours of actually only flying within 1 month. And besides 90 hours of flying, you also have other hours of doing other things that you do in the airport, or, you know, like having briefings with your colleagues, to your supervisors, and so on and so on. So it's just exhausting, actually.
Yeah, it's exhausting. Yeah. So you always put depression on some sort of not having a reasonable perception of the world, where you actually see the world as it is.
Mm-hmm.
Because depression and desperation gave you to that point where you can see the rules of society. The problem is that you don't see how to get out of them,
mm-hmm.
and don't remember the time before that, so you just see the making of society, which makes it so difficult to just to imagine or hope that something is going to change.
Mm.
You see the understructure of it, and seeing the understructure in a very clear way, it's what puts you into this state of mind. But it's not like you're delusional. You just see things as they are, and it's very difficult to get that small embrace of hope that, okay, you can share some of the aspects and the struggle would be easier.
Can I ask you something? So we also now are a little bit going into this field of depression within institutions or place of work or working conditions, and also care within it. What would you share about that topic? Like, what would you say?
I think depression institution is still a taboo.
Mm-hmm.
I know most of the institutions, especially the academical ones, tend to push this aside,
mm-hmm.
because also there are the production of knowledge is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that you as a person, you have to produce text,
mm-hmm.
that it's a process that takes time, that takes passion, and this you need some reflexivity, but
mm-hmm.
you're basically a machine that has to write and
mm-hmm.
put this entire culture of commentaries together. It's very exhausting. And not all the institutions have like even a consultant to which you can go and talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very limited number of consultations that you have access to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in eastern part of Europe, I don't even know if many of the university actually have this program. For me, at least, it was one of the most difficult situation, I think, because I just felt that it's even difficult to complain. If everything happened in your life, you didn't find, you know, additional job to the scholarship you were offered and so forth, it was your fault, and you shouldn't whine about it, and you shouldn't be so weak, and, you know, brush those tears.
Mm-hmm.
You have work
mm-hmm.
to do, you have to produce,
mm-hmm.
and you have to apply for grants, and you have to get published, and it's this and that journals. And all this puts so much pressure on you very early, that then even to speak about it becomes like an act of guilt.
Mm-hmm.
How do you address this situation? Also as a female,
mm-hmm.
then you're like, oh, you're emotional because you're a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And women always make such a drama of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that's your state of, you're depressive because you're like such a sensitive, such a woman, you should toughen up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always this difficulty into addressing the question or talking about these situations in the first place. And even when you talk, you're being seen as some kind of person that doesn't have their life together,
mm-hmm.
because they are so emotional.
Mm-hmm.
So you lack the reasonability of making a structured plan for yourself and presenting to other, look, I'm actually an efficient person that does this and that, and it's able to perform.
Mm-hmm.
But this lack of addressing the issue in institution, it's still a problem that it's very slowly tackled. And what care means in an institution, it's such a big issue, because it should imply more personal contact. All the things that we think are difficult to address, also because you have hierarchies, you know?
Mm-hmm.
How do you address your supervisor? And they're like, I'm sorry, I couldn't write that paper because I was depressed and I don't see the end of my work, or like what could come up out of it, or if I have a future or not as a person that has trained for this for so long.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a...
Mm-hmm.
sensitive subject to address,
mm-hmm.
and especially in a male-dominated world.
And do you think are there any practices that you could just mention or give as an example that kind of challenge this sort of situation or model? Or
I think one of the ways of dealing with these are forms of community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's so difficult to name what is, how do you get mm-hmm. all these things, or like all these practices together. One of them will be, of course, more personal meetings, mm-hmm. less dialogue that is so stiff, more like these niceties, like, I hope this email finds you well.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
What this well means.
Yes.
And should I say, like, I'm sorry, I'm having a breakdown now. Doesn't find me well at
all. I'm sorry for replying this late, but I had a breakdown.
Yes, I'm sorry for my late reply, which also has become one of the standard beginnings of my email. Yes, like my computer already predicts that.
Yeah.
That's how I'm going to
yeah.
start an email. But also all this... And it doesn't have to be a personal level in which you are intruding, but just to let the other person know that they have a bit of support, that they are not alone in this situation, especially with creative processes that take time, that you are in your head so much, it's very difficult to get out of there, and also to face in the same at the same time precarious conditions. It kind of makes for such a struggle to even speak about. So just I was just thinking, like, what practices of care would mean,
mm-hmm.
but I think it's always a level of empathy that you have to put out there, and addressing the issue not by being intrusive,
mm-hmm.
but by being careful and caring in the way that to understand that the person next to you, it's not a producer, it's an individual that has to face similar conditions.
Mm. And also I think it has something to do with, you know, if we speak about practices of care, and then it can be, as you said, on a personal level, it can be on a collective level,
yes.
as well, then with the collective, it's also about acknowledging the dynamics that do differ from
exactly.
group to group,
mm-hmm.
and that actually we shouldn't be in a way afraid of these dynamics just because we are dealing with the topic we are dealing, like, such as depression.
Mm-hmm.
So, because I also feel that not only that talking about depression or sharing experiences and attitudes about depression are still kind of a taboo or not happening enough. I also think even when they happen, there is a lot of caution that people take while they are communicating about it. Just in terms that when somebody wants to give care and help to somebody, it's always like with this sort of feeling, oh, you know, I just don't want to, I don't know, hurt the person, or I don't want to offend somebody, or you get into this, let's say, kind of a moralistic judging of your actions before you even start acting. And I think this is all, of course, normal, and it to the certain level should still happen. Of course, we have to take care how we communicate about it, but also I think it's important to a little bit put down this image and heaviness around it, because it is a heavy subject by itself. I think it's also about us, all of us, approaching to it a little bit with less fear and more with the fact that it is conditions that we are living, some of us more, some of us less.
Yes.
This depends of the power of relations we are intertwined within, but still we can address it and communicate about it without such a fear that we will make some mistakes. Even if we do make mistakes, just the fact that we are addressing it is already a strong political act.
I think it's also a form of sharing, because when you want to help someone, usually we do this thing that, oh, it's someone that is in need, and you feel, you position yourself in a you know, like it's a more like a power position, that you are the strong one that's going to help the weak one.
Yeah.
And it's never like that. Yeah. We all are in different, we have these different moments.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than addressing it in this form of, okay, I'm going to help you because you need it, because you are weak, it's how you can share with that person that this state they are going through and give them time and understanding. Mm-hmm.
It's this, I like to use this quote a lot, especially when it comes to care, that we should acknowledge that we are individuals with different social, physical and mental abilities and capabilities, and that actually we should keep searching for ways through which we can keep helping each other even when we don't actually know each other.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I combined a little bit quotations from Martha Nussbaum and Judith Butler, but it is actually something that to me still resonates, even though I read it or heard about it many years ago. But somehow, when you look around and you see that we have different, not only abilities and capabilities, but also power positions that are constantly in negotiation, in a constant process of negotiation, just like you said, in a way, then it is about something to find a way how to keep the awareness about it, and that's that awareness act.
Yes. We'll be right back.
feel I should give more space to growth, but when I think I take care of myself, I realize I am living within a rhetoric of a camouflage that system performs through the choreography of individualizing an overall stress. Burnout, only mine alone. Depression, only mine alone. Mental illness, only mine alone. Rare disease, only mine alone. Anxiety, only mine alone. Addiction, only mine alone. Housing crisis, only mine alone. Unstable currency, only mine alone. Too high interest rates, only mine alone. Excessive effort, but a disproportionate gain, only mine alone. Impermanence, only mine alone. Bureaucratic vortex, only mine alone. Digital loneliness, only mine alone. Encased body in the cage of the screen, only mine alone. Advertising bombing the social brain, only mine alone. Domestic violence, only mine alone. Public harassment, only mine alone. A feeling of inadequacy, only mine alone. Reflexive impotence, only mine alone. Suicide, only mine alone. There's no such thing as society, only individual men and women. Margaret Thatcher made it airborne.
In order to have hope is actually to accept we are living in a hopeless
circumstances. Yes. I was thinking the same thing when just we were talking about hope, and I was just like, it's so difficult, because the feeling that you are confronted the most, it's actually hopelessness.
Mm.
That you feel that everything is going to repeat itself and you cannot get out of that repetition.
Mm.
And it's not a question of snapping out, it's just a question that remembering that things used to be different.
Mm-hmm.
You used to see a lot of diversity, so you can get back to that point. And that is the point of hope.
Mm-hmm.
Hoping that in all this situation, there are small changes that you can get, that you could be aware of,
mm-hmm.
and that would move a little bit this hopelessness out of your way of seeing, but also understanding that this is the condition with which we are confronted,
mm-hmm.
then this huge mass of hopelessness about what you're going to do, nothing changes, things are getting worse and worse and worse, and it's because the same repetition, whether it is neoliberal strategies, whether it is corruption, how government instrumentalize people.
I think nowadays it seems like new approaches, if we could say radical approaches, actually center around the fact that we should accept hopelessness in terms that we cannot actually come up with new proposals of new models of living, because if we could so far, then this would change, of course. But that in a way maybe it is okay to accept to be dreamless, not in terms of giving up on life, but in terms of relaxing or relieving ourselves from this push that we have to produce something
and
new.
The expectations of that to happen.
Because such thing, even though
it should be a fight against the overall system, in the end becomes part of the system. Mm-hmm. Because you're again pushed to produce something new, like to such as capitalism always works, right? So there is something about this radicality of like not go thinking that we have to act and just immediately produce something new in order to change, but that we should actually sit down and think and also become aware about the conditions that we are living in.
Yes, and it's also this, how we can create a feeling of community or new strategies, because, you know, in conditions of crisis, it's people come together. Mm-hmm. And it's not a question of thinking of how to come together. They just do.
Yes.
Because it is this very specific problem that they have to address, and it's a matter of, you know, life and death, basically.
Of course.
Then the question is, how you can maintain these forms of community that come together and not let them become something that, you know, when a community crystallizes, mm-hmm. it already creates some form of hierarchy or structure mm-hmm. of power. Mm-hmm. Even if you try to maintain everything horizontally, in order to do that, you have to put some very strong guidelines mm-hmm. or create these negotiations that even on an ethical level, you know, can create other forms of hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
The question is that how to let communities come together, maintain them as community that come together without imposing a specific structure
exactly.
to them.
Exactly. And I just want to illustrate what you said in through one example. In Serbia in 2014 we had this flooding
mm-hmm.
and it was really as you said, it was a crisis, it was a very dangerous situation. So for me it was incredible that in such moment people, everyone got together and started building these blocks to basically block water to pass through
mm-hmm.
and going to different cities wherever it was possible. It was like a social action that suddenly emerged and happened
yes.
spontaneously within the crisis, of course. But then in such moment it really wasn't important who belongs to whom, which political party, who is gay, who is straight, who actually performs what sort of social role that we all perform every day. The only goal was we have to help people not die and lose houses from this flooding. And so I bring this example in relation to what you said, just because it is about, like you said, coming up with models of communities without imposing structures or power, but also I think at the same time keeping the awareness among people that such thing happens when the crisis occurs.
Yes.
So if we mm-hmm. act like that in crisis, why cannot we
yeah.
act like that
when
in a regular life?
Yes.
Why do we have to go back into our roles
mm-hmm.
that only 1 week afterwards a straight nationalist football fan was still beating a gay person, you know?
That's what I'm saying. So the question is how you can maintain or like transfer these communities to a moment that it's not such a well-defined as a crisis that implies, you know, emergency and survival kit. But how this the community can become a survival kit in the sense of how to face our current conditions.
Yes.
Because we call it capitalism, but God knows what it already is,
mm-hmm.
you know? And invoking this divine authority only makes it like we don't know what we are confronted with anymore. It's you don't even know if this is capitalism or feudalism or whatever it is. Because to think about the fact that nobody still holds property as a way of life, it's also liberating, but then who has the property,
mm-hmm.
you know? Then you think that, okay, the property belongs to someone, and then you are in debt to that someone.
Mm-hmm.
And I also remember now, because we were talking about radicalism and resistance, about this quote from Ulrike Meinhof, and she says, like, protest is
mm-hmm.
when I say I don't like this.
Mm-hmm.
Resistance is when I make sure that nobody else gets through the same issues.
Uh-huh. You remember this sort of like paradigmatical transition between like Foucault and Deleuze and Guattari, but from this like society of this, it basically implies that there is no like more understanding of the system that is above us, that controls us and disciplines us, but that is, there is a system created out of relations of power among people. Mm-hmm. And within these relations of power, it's all the, let's say, problematic aspects like patriarchy, I don't know, white supremacy, LGBT rights, women rights, whatever, that is included.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, this is where we are actually as a society. Even though we should keep diagnosing and critically pointing and analyzing the fact that we are suffering from the system we are part of,
we
also produce it.
Yeah.
And this is something that we rarely acknowledge.
Subject and discussion.
Yes, but it's really nice to have with you. It's again 1 hour that we have.